This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Our guest, Alec Baldwin, is appearing in two movies this summer, Woody Allen's To Rome with Love and Rock of Ages, adapted from the Broadway musical. Two very different roles for an actor who's had a career of interesting turns. In the 80s and 90s, he became a Hollywood star with his leading man looks and roles in films including Beetlejuice, Married to the Mob, Working Girl, Glengarry Glen Ross, and Hunt for Red October. But he's also found success in comedy, guest hosting Saturday Night Live for a record 16 times, and for six seasons playing TV executive Jack Donaghy in the hit NBC series 30 Rock. In the new movies, he plays a long-haired club owner in the musical Rock of Ages, and in Woody Allen's film To Rome with Love, he plays a middle-aged architect who's vacationing in Rome, where he'd lived decades before. Walking around the city, he meets a young man played by Jesse Eisenberg and goes to the apartment where the young man lives with his girlfriend, played by Greta Gerwig. Baldwin's character becomes a muse of sorts, giving Eisenberg's character advice only he can hear, as he does in this scene when Gerwig's character explains that an old friend is coming to visit.
Oh, my gosh. My friend, Monica, she called. She's going to be in Rome, and I told her she could stay with us.
So I'll finally get to meet her.
She just broke up with her boyfriend, so she's a bit at loose ends.
Trouble. Trouble in River City.
What trouble? Why trouble?
You're just gonna love her. She's smart and funny and interesting. Men just adore her. I think it's because of the sexual vibe that she gives off.
Mm-hmm. And how long is she coming for?
Oh, I don't know. Between the breakup and then her acting career isn't going that well.
Jesus Christ, can't you see the situation is fraught with peril?
Oh, give me a break. Her friend is coming. What do I care? I'm not looking for anything. I'm perfectly happy with Sally. And actually, judging from Sally's description, Monica's kind of like a neurotic, unpredictable type.
Beautiful, funny, smart, sexual, and also neurotic. It's like filling an inside straight. Monica. Even her name is hot.
Well, Alec Baldwin, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, your character, John, is an architect, and he's older now, and he used to live in Rome, and he's sort of seeing these kids go through stuff like things he may have gone through. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about your character, John, and the role he plays with these three young people that he's around?
Well, my character is in Rome on vacation with my wife and two other friends, and I leave them at the onset of our segment. I leave them and I go off and take a walk, and then it winds up being a very particular walk. I'm kind of walking through time, really, and I meet someone who arguably or not is a younger me, and I go back in time to witness these events and things like that and situations in Rome that it may or may not be me literally speaking to my younger self and trying to get that younger guy to avoid some of the mistakes he made.
Did you have a backstory in your head about John's life?
Yeah. I think that you really don't need one. You know, with Woody, you know, it's all there. You know, there's a lot of times if the film is not as well written, you wind up hungering for things that aren't there. As an actor, sometimes you get very kind of proppy. I've done films where you're like, well, let's talk about my character's luggage. You know, you kind of go crazy because you're thinking you're struggling for things to kind of fill in these holes because there's just not enough on the page for you to play. And I think if it's well written and you have a pretty clear understanding of what everybody wants, you just say the words to the best of your ability and it pretty much takes care of itself.
You know, you're here in this film playing a guy with young people who are engaged in this romantic fling that, you know, seems familiar and making mistakes. And you're kind of giving the Jesse Eisenberg character advice from the perspective of experience. And it occurred to me you're an actor here, a veteran who's been around a lot with two very young, very successful actors. Well, three, really, Jesse Eisenberg, Ellen Page, and Greta Gerwig. Did you feel kind of this relationship replicated at all on the set, like you were, I don't know, new things and that they didn't and could help them?
Well, I don't think I would ever try to tell people anything about the work they're doing in general, but let alone people who are at that level, because all of them are very experienced. You know, Ellen is someone who's made a lot of films, and she's very successful in the film business, and she's very talented. I mean, it's just apparent when you work with her just how gifted she is in the way she can act in front of a camera. And Jesse, too. I mean, I always remember when I saw the movie Roger Dodger years ago, how I fell in love with his acting, and I really liked him a lot. Greta, I had not seen as much. But she's wonderful, too, and very direct, you know, and keeps it very simple, which I like. And I would never dream of saying anything to them. You know, like if someone asked me something and they said, oh, what do you think? And with Woody, most often people talk to each other like, do you think he liked it? Because Woody's so
right,
quiet.
Right.
I think all of us turn to each other and say, do you think he's liking what we're doing? Like Jesse would say, how do you think this is going? And I'd say, I don't know. How do you think it's going? So it's all, it's a little, yeah, Woody's so quiet. You know, he's so, you know, recessed. He doesn't really talk a lot. So it's you do get a little pangs of insecurity sometimes.
Right. So how did any of you ever know that you were getting it right? He moved
you
on.
You didn't. You didn't. If you remained in the film and weren't cut out of the film, that was a clue that he kind of liked what you did. But it's the opposite of what you get a lot in filmmaking, where people walk up to you and say everything's great. You know, you do something that's very plain or very ordinary or very simple or even banal, and people are walking up to you saying, that was great. You know, and you do get, I mean, some people I know, they don't want that either. You know, they don't want to be rewarded for nothing. But I think that, you know, that we really were all the same, actually. We were all in the same boat, which was, A, we were in Rome, which is just an incredible place to shoot. And we were all very happy to be in Rome because Woody shoots very civil days. There are sometimes you make films and you travel places, and the take that people in the business have is that the worst way to see a city is to shoot there, because you work these long, you know, 12 and 13 and 14 hour days, and you go home to the hotel, you eat, or you go to the gym and you pass out, and you don't have a chance to explore, unless of course you have a lot of days off, you have a more forgiving schedule. But Woody shoots very civil days. You know, you work 10 or 11 hours, you know, never long days. He likes to work at a very moderate pace. And he wants to work hard. He wants everyone to know their lines and get to the better take as soon as possible. We can't really luxuriate. But this was an opportunity to relax and to see Rome. You know, every night we would go for nice walks. My girlfriend and I would walk around Rome, and I just love Rome. I mean, Rome really does cast a spell on you.
Well, maybe some people were surprised to see you in Rock of Ages. You're there, a middle-aged guy with long hair who owns a bar called, what is it, the Bourbon Club?
The Bourbon Room.
The Bourbon Room, right. Were you a rocker back in the 70s and 80s? Did you connect with this at all?
No. I mean, I listened to the music I listened to growing up, but I wasn't somebody who was got into the hair and the you know, the clothes and the jewelry.
And going to concerts and headbanging.
I went to some concerts in the 70s when I was a kid. I went to, not a lot, but I went to a few. But I never was much of a, you know, wearing a vest and a Kiss t-shirt and a lot of beads and stuff like that. I wasn't in tattoos. I didn't do that. But I think that, oddly enough, this period is right around the time that I turned off popular music on the radio, and I almost never listened to it again after that. About 1985, that was when I kind of switched over to classical music, and I discovered classical music in the radio in Los Angeles, and I've pretty much stayed with that since then. There's almost no popular music I listen to now. I mean, I'll hear it because it's everywhere. It's in the gym or it's in the coffee shop. It's playing and it's in the shopping mall. You know, music is ubiquitous now. But music of that type tends to speak to people, you know, in their teens or their 20s, you know, when they're younger. And I was getting closer to 30 then. So I just had no desire to listen to that music of my youth, you know. And I still listen to music every now and then from my youth, you know, the Stones and the Beatles and the Who and Led Zeppelin and Woodstock and Crosby, Stills and this and that. There's a lot of music from my childhood and my youth that I still listen to. The radio show that I do for WNYC, we just interviewed Peter Frampton for that show, and mm-hmm. It was really a thrill because he had that great iconic album he released in 75, I believe.
So how did you end up in this film? It's, you know, it's based on...
I have no idea. I have literally no idea. Obviously, there were six other guys they wanted and they couldn't get them.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And they came to me and asked me to do it.
There's a moment I wanted to play from the film. This is a scene where you get to sing with Russell Brand, who's also at the club, and you discover that your friendship is perhaps something more, and you sing this duet. It's the old REO Speedwagon song, Can't Fight This Feeling. Let's listen. We hear Russell Brand sing first.
I can't fight this feeling any longer, and yet I'm still afraid to let it flow. What started out as friendship has grown stronger. I only wish I had the strength to let it show. I tell myself that I can't hold out forever. I said there is no reason for my fear, 'cause I feel so secure when we're together. You give my life direction, you make everything so clear.
And that is our guest, Alec Baldwin, with Russell Brand singing Can't
Doesn't
Stop
Doesn't Russell
this,
sound great?
Can't Fight This Feeling. Oh, I think you managed to pull this off pretty well. Have you
well,
done
that, I think there's a lot of that's the computer. They put you through the sweetener there. I think they put professional musicians through the sweetener, so why not me?
Right.
But can't you see how Russell could be a real rock star? I mean, he is such an exotic animal. When I worked with him, I love him, first of all. I had more fun with him than probably, I mean, I had one of the best times of my life with him. He's funny and smart. I had a ball with him. I mean, I think other than seeing Tom Cruise do what Tom did, which was so overwhelming, I mean, Tom really, really became the character. And unlike me, who I don't think I really can sing, even though I might have it in my head or my heart, I just don't have the vocal cords really to sing well. But Tom went and studied with a vocal coach and a dance coach, and he had all these people he rehearsed with and worked so hard for several weeks before they rolled the camera. And Tom came in, and I mean, everybody's mouth was on the floor. He just knocked everybody out. You could have just made a movie about Tom.
It's pretty amazing. And, I mean, he plays this iconic rock star
so
who performs
great.
Without his shirt and just, right, well.
Well, Tom, you know, it's funny because everybody thinks, I mean, I used to have the same attitude. I used to look at people in the business as I came up and saw them who were pure movie actors of a certain type, where a lot of the technology is at the fore and action, and the demands for them in terms of acting were not that great. And, I, you know, Tom is one of the biggest movie stars of the last 50 years, and he's had a great career in films. But he's taken time along the way to do other things, to, you know, whether it's Magnolia or whether it's Born on the 4th of July. I mean, he still has a career he has to tend to as a great movie star in that sense. But he stops along the way. Tropic Thunder was something recently. And then he did this, and I can't tell you how impressed everyone was. And I think Russell really knocked people out because he's so funny.
But I did want to get back to the scene where you and he discover your affection for one another. It ends with a kiss. You want to just talk a little bit about making that scene?
I mean, I enjoyed kissing Russell more than most of the women I've had to kiss in the movies, you know, because I just really liked him so much, you know. I mean, some of the women I've worked with in film, not that I didn't like them, but they certainly weren't anywhere near as interesting as Russell. Some of them were, but some of them weren't, because Russell's just such a kind of a fascinating character. And you don't really think about that. I mean, in this day and age, I've been sent scripts, not now because I'm older, but I was sent scripts years ago, 10, 15 years ago, where they wanted you to have love scenes with another guy. You know, before Brokeback Mountain, there were people who were pushing that kind of an envelope where they wanted you to have I'm not saying hardcore sex, but they wanted you to have intimacy with someone in a film. And I never really bothered me because I thought, well, it's not me doing that, it's the character. And even though I might not have the predilection for that, you have to play the part. You know, when it's the old line, you know, when you have to play Hitler, you got to play Hitler.
Well, I'm glad that at least this kiss was with somebody that it meant something to you.
It meant a great deal to me.
Great. In the 80s and 90s, you did so many dramatic roles that got a lot of attention, you know, Working Girls, Glengarry, Glenn Ross, Hunt for Red October. And I know that you started in TV. You know, you did a daytime soap and then Knots Landing. Did you ever imagine you'd be working in a TV sitcom?
I didn't really think about it. I had put my toe in the water to do a television show, and most of it had to do with lifestyle. I was divorced, and my daughter lived in Los Angeles. And I needed to have a regular schedule. And in the film business, very often, you have no idea where you're going to be 6 months from now. You know, you wake up one day and someone says, we're going to go to Australia. And there may be a creative opportunity there or even a commercial opportunity there. But I grew very weary of that. And television to me was, although it wasn't necessarily as creatively diverse as filmmaking can be, it was the lifestyle choice that I needed to make. And then Lorne Michaels, who's been a friend of mine for years, came to me and said, do you want to do this show? And I thought, well, it shoots in New York. Tina's the writer, and Tina's obviously an incredibly talented woman. And
Tina Fey, yeah.
Tina Fey. And the schedule was such where it really was easy for me to have time off to go see my daughter, who lives in Los Angeles. So I was commuting there a lot. I would go there every other weekend when she was much younger. And I did that show, and then the miracle was that it was creatively as successful as it was. I mean, the ratings for 30 Rock have never been big, but creatively it was a big, big bonanza. You know, there was after the second year, that second, third, and fourth year, we won all these prizes again and again and again. And everybody was very gratified by that. And plus, there was the thing where we were up against Sorkin's show. Sorkin wrote Studio 60, and we thought, you know, they're going to win and we're going to lose. They're going to get rid of one of us. And we thought it was definitely going to be us because of Sorkin and Matthew Perry and Brad Whitford. And there was all these people who had these legacy relationships with NBC. But we survived and we were kind of blown away by that. So we did the show. And now this coming fall, we have 13 episodes in a shortened 7th season. And then we're done. We're off the air. The show is over.
Well, let's listen to a clip. You're seen as Jack Donaghy. He's a TV executive. And, of course, Tina Fey plays Liz Lemon, who I guess is the head writer of a show, kind of like herself. And the relationship between the two is fascinating. This is a scene from season 6 where Jack Donaghy has seen Tina Fey kissing a man on the street and tries to find out who she's seeing. And usually she confides a lot of her life to him. She suspects he won't approve of this new guy. Anyway, let's listen.
Lemon?
I'm on top of the Tracy thing. I just spoke to him.
Actually, I want to talk to you about something else. Because of my unfortunate situation with Avery, I'm alone. And I know, of course, that you're not seeing anyone. Therefore, I've decided that you and I should become friends with benefits.
No, thank you, please.
Aha! The only reason you would reject that offer is if you had a secret boyfriend.
Right. That's the only reason.
I saw you, Lemon, at the movies last night with your mouth on a man. Why would you keep this from me after all of our time together? This is hurtful, Elizabeth. What's his name?
I don't want to tell you.
Why? Is it a stupid name like Dakota or Barack?
His name is Chris, and I'm sorry, but for my own
reason.
And
Chris is spelled?
No H and two S's. That, right there. That's why I didn't want to tell you, because I knew you wouldn't approve of him.
Why? What does he do for a living?
Chris is trying to...
You can stop right there.
He's an entrepreneur. He is currently meeting with investors in the hopes of starting an organic gourmet hot dog truck.
Lemon, I have said good God to you before, but I don't think I've ever meant it until now. Good God! Where does this person live?
Don't worry about it.
How bad can it be? Jersey City? His parents' apartment? It's not a walk-up, is it?
And that's our guest, Alec Baldwin and Tina Fey on 30 Rock. You've known a lot of entertainment executives in your days. Did you draw on any of them in creating Jack Donaghy?
When the show first started, GE owned NBC, or they had the controlling interest in NBC. And so we spent many years sending up the GE culture. But in a very funny way, and the GE people would laugh. Jeff Immelt would come to the set like once or twice a year and say, hey, you guys are funny. And the character was kind of a prototype of a GE executive, And in his personal life, in his personal ethic, he's Lorne Michaels. He's going to live a certain lifestyle in terms of comfort and creature comforts. And as I always say, Lorne is someone who has a tuxedo in the glove compartment of his car. And he just is, he goes to events, and he's very much a pillar of the social network and the power structure of New York media and so forth. And so, and Lorne is a friend, and I adore Lorne, but we do stick it to Lorne a lot.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. We're speaking with actor Alec Baldwin. He starred in dozens of movies, including Beetlejuice, Married to the Mob, Glengarry Glen Ross, and Hunt for Red October. He's appearing in two new films, the musical Rock of Ages and the new Woody Allen comedy To Rome with Love. And for six seasons, he's played TV executive Jack Donaghy in the hit NBC series 30 Rock. Baldwin said while his character is often described as arrogant, he doesn't see the role that way.
To me, I never think of it as smug or arrogant or self-important. I just think of it as a guy who's in a hurry, and he has no apologies. You know, he's someone who, I mean, there's a lot of people today who you go into rooms with people, and you're trying to convince people to do what you want them to do. You're trying to get permission from them to do what you want to do. And this guy's much more of a, you know, from the Patton school. You know, you don't ask, you tell. You don't wait to see how people feel about it. You know, we don't sit down and hold hands in some human resources meeting to make sure everybody's okay with the orders I'm giving. This guy's very old school, and that is you just tell people what to do, and you're just much more direct. And I never think of it, never do I think, oh, how can I make this guy more arrogant, bombastic? I think to myself, he's either something he wants or something he wants to get done, and there's a way that he does it.
For him, life is simply more efficient if everyone recognizes that what he's the way he sees things.
If everyone would just if everyone would just do what I tell them to do, when I tell them to do it, the way I tell them to do it, everything would be fine. and you would benefit too. All of you would benefit from it too if you would just listen to me. Everything would be great. That's kind of he's from that school.
I want to play one more clip. This is a clip from the third season of 30 Rock, in which Liz Lemon, Tina Fey's character, has been dating a guy, Drew, who's played by John Hamm, who's very handsome. And she has come back from lunch with a doggy bag from a very exclusive restaurant called Plunder. And she's just amazed at the way life is when you're with someone who is this attractive. And your character, Jack Donaghy, explains about the bubble. Let's listen.
You went to Plunder for lunch? How did you get a table?
I don't know. It was packed, but they just gave Drew a table. It is ridiculous how people treat him. The chef sent over food, ladies sent drinks, Mayor Bloomberg asked him to dance.
Well, beautiful people are treated differently from moderately pleasant-looking people.
It's true.
They live in a bubble. A bubble of free drinks, kindness, and outdoor sex.
How did Drew turn out as well as he did going through life like that?
The bubble isn't always a bad thing. Look at me. I turned out okay, didn't I?
Jack, I want you to pay close attention to the following over-the-top eye roll. Oh, brother.
Lemon, I don't share this often, but this is a photo of me when I was 25 years old.
What the what? You have a Superman chest.
I know.
Oh, my God, the lady will have two tickets to the gun show. And your eyes are so much bluer. What happened to your eyes?
My point is, Lemon, the bubble doesn't last forever. So get in there with Drew and enjoy those perks while you can.
Can I keep that?
No. It's my only copy.
How awful. Our guest, Alec Baldwin, with Tina Fey in on the season 3 scene from 30 Rock. When you got that script, did you think about your days, I don't know, in a different kind of bubble when you were in your 20s and a hunk of Hollywood?
When I made films, I really didn't kind of understand what I got myself into. You know, that's another thing I love about Tom. We did Rock of Ages. Was Tom was someone who he had a better understanding of what he had gotten himself into. You know, like and how to ride that wave. And because movie making is a very unique thing, and making movies on that level is a very unique thing. And I did that for a few years, and I realized that you really do need to make it the most important thing in your life, which I guess I wasn't willing to do. You know, starring in films for studios and, you know, those kind of big-ticket films, you get a period of time, especially when you're younger, and then when that doesn't work out, your career evolves into something else. You go do independent films, and there's less money at stake, and it's more I think it's less risky, the investment for people, obviously. And then you turn around and you're 40. And then you turn around and you're 50. I think the thing to try to do along the way is just to try to learn more about acting and how to do it better, you know, whatever that means, to economize and to commit and to be more honest and to try to vary it and not duplicate what you've done before. That's the one thing about the TV show that is tough, is that you do play in the same key all the time, and even though the writing itself is clever, when the show ends, I guess it is ending at a good time, because I do find myself very, very ready to stop playing in that key, because it has been 7 years.
You know, I read an interview with you in 2009 when you said you thought that your acting career would end with 30 Rock, and sort of imagined yourself maybe growing old with a kid who didn't even know you were in the movies.
Right.
Now I look and I see you've got, I think, 5 movies in production or pre-production. I guess your thinking changed on this.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't know where people. I think IMDb sometimes just prints, you know, your name is attached to anything if your name comes up.
Okay. That's the Internet Movie Database that everybody uses, including us, and maybe should less. You're telling us.
Right. Well, no, I love IMDb. I think it's a great resource, but I think that they just have a tendency to say any film that you're even remotely discussed doing, they put that down as pending. But the only film I'm going to do is Woody's new film this fall. And then I'm supposed to do a play in New York. I can't say what it is yet, but I think I'm going to do a play in February. And then I would like to do something else for a while. I'd like to stop doing this for a while because I've done it for 32 years. And I'm very, very intrigued by that idea to have a nice big piece of time off and do something completely unrelated to what I'm doing now.
But you have done some interesting things lately in radio. You still host the New York Philharmonic show on W, the classical music station in New York?
The New York Philharmonic This Week, which is their program that airs on QXR in New York. It's produced by WFMT in Chicago. I've been the radio announcer for them. This is the end of my third season just ended. That's one of my favorite things I've ever done, because just to be a part of that, such a soothing and an elegant world of the classical repertoire is such a joy for me. And then I have my own show on WNYC, Here's the Thing, that podcasts on the NYC website, and then we're going to go to broadcast, I think, this fall. And that I've really enjoyed as well, because I love to talk to people and get down to a different kind of conversation about, you know, not so much the facts, like, well, then you did this, and then you did this, and then you did this, and more talk about how they feel about what they do and what they're really, and try to ask questions that I know I don't get asked that often, and I had a hunch that they didn't either.
You know, you've talked about running for office also at times, mayor of New York, the Senate. Is that something you still think about?
Well, I think that it's tough these days. I mean, I've had these difficulties lately with the press. I've had this stuff here in New York where I was this guy almost hit me in the face with a camera here in New York the other day. And I find that it's very, very difficult now to navigate those waters. I mean, everybody I've ever worked with, you know, 99.9% of the time, I've had a successful or at least, very agreeable experience with. And there are these legit press opportunities you have that you do, and then there's what I call the illegitimate press. And they, in the age of the Internet, they're very strong. They're very omnipresent, and dealing with them becomes, I think for me, what I'm learning now in this last go-round is that my desire to live a normal life, like to have an apartment in New York and a home in New York and to walk out the door like any other New Yorker does and just live my life, sometimes it's not possible. And I know people who live this much more insulated life in Los Angeles where their feet like never touch public ground. They walk out of their bathroom, they walk out of their living room, they walk into their garage, they get in their car, and the next thing you know, they're at the valet parking of the restaurant or the store or the office. They're just never, they're in a bubble the whole time. It's very hermetic. And I never wanted to live that kind of life. I hated that idea. But I'm beginning to see now how it really does become necessary, kind of. It's sad. It makes me sad, but it's true.
Well, Alec Baldwin, it's been great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Alec Baldwin appears in the new musical Rock of Ages and the new Woody Allen comedy To Roam with Love. And he'll play TV executive Jack Donaghy for the seventh and final season on the NBC series 30 Rock. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Fiona Apple's new album called The Idler Wheel is Wiser Than the Driver of the Screw and Whipping Cords Will Serve You More Than Ropes Will Ever Do. Yes, that's the title. It's her first album in 5 years, and Ken says the frequently stripped-down sound is a backdrop for her thoughts about the complications of love.
Every single night, I endure the flight of little wings of white flame, butterflies in my brain. These ideas of mine percolate the mind, trickle down the spine, swarm the belly, swelling to a blaze. That's where the pain comes in, like a second skeleton trying to fit beneath the skin. I can't fit the feelings in.
These ideas of mine percolate the mind, Fiona Apple sings on Every Single Night, the song that opens her album, The Idler Wheel is Wiser Than the Driver of the Screw, and Whipping Cords Will Serve You More Than Ropes Will Ever Do. Some people are going to listen to the entire album and come away with the feeling that the percolation in Apple's mind has bubbled over like a coffee pot left too long on a stove. But for me, and perhaps for you, Apple's bubbling thoughts, words, and music are thrilling. Eager and direct, heedless about being judged or misunderstood.
My cheeks were reflecting the longest wavelength. My fan was folded up and grazing my forehead. And I kept touching my
The Idler Wheel is primarily a collaboration between Apple and percussionist co-producer Charlie Drayton. The clattering sounds that form the spine of many melodies here are made by everything from drums to pebbles tossed down a garbage chute. The contrast between Apple's moist, enveloping confessional lyrics and the dry, sometimes harsh music is often a wonderfully stark, dramatic one.
You didn't see my Valentine. I sent it via pantomime while you were watching someone else. I stared at you and cut myself. It's all I'll do, 'cause I'm not free. A fugitive too dull to flee. I'm amorous but out of reach. It's still life drawing of a peach. I'm a tulip in a cup.
One gets the idea that socializing with Ms. Apple is no small commitment. As the vehement piano playing and vocal on that song Valentine suggest, when she's on your side, she can be a tad obsessive. That's part of what I take away from a chorus that goes, I root for you, I love you, 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 you. And sharing a meal might become quite the endurance test when she reveals, quote, I made it to a dinner date, my teardrops seasoned every plate. I mean it as a compliment to say that Apple is working in the literary tradition of the difficult woman, closing in on Virginia Woolf and already superior to Sylvia Plath. Apple's achievement is to both indulge in melodrama and to isolate the hard truths behind her extravagant emotions. I was never, not for a moment, put off by Apple's constant fingering of her feelings, because she describes them with such vigorous music and in such rigorous rhyme.
They throw good parties there. those peripheral idiots always have a bite to bear. Bear it if you can, if you really want to. Go to the periphery.
The vocals on The Idler Wheel demonstrate a striking range, from jazzy croon to blues howl to pop conversational. It's a measure of Apple's artistry that she has labored so intensively to give the sustained impression that she's alone in a room. She's listening to the sounds in her head, describing them and the images and emotions they inspire as she listens along with us. As intense as she is, she's awfully good company.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Fiona Apple's new album.
A fun butter, a fun butter, a fun butter them. He's a hot knife, he makes my heart a cinema score. Squeeze show him a dancing bird of paradise. A fun butter, a fun butter, a fun butter them. He's a hot knife, he makes my heart a cinema score. Squeeze show him a dancing bird of paradise. He excites me, must be like the Genesis rhythm. I get feisty whenever I'm with him. If I'm butter, if I'm butter, if I'm butter, then he's a hot knife. He makes my heart a cinema skoski, showing the dancing bird of paradise.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Just days before student loan rates are set to double for millions of Americans, President Obama and congressional leaders haven't reached an agreement on legislation to keep those rates at 3.4%. The debate reflects the growing concern over the debt burden many acquire to get a college education these days. About two-thirds of bachelor's degree recipients borrow money to attend college, and many struggle to find jobs after they graduate. Unpaid student debt has now reached $1 trillion. Our guest, Kevin Carey, believes the student debt crisis reflects larger, troubling trends in higher education, among them excessive spending by colleges and universities, which drives up tuition, and declining government support for public universities as state and local governments face budget crises. Kevin Carey is director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation, and he's written on education issues for The New Republic, Washington Monthly, The American Prospect, and The Chronicle of Higher Education. Well, Kevin Carey, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, you write that the burden students come out of college with really represents an intergenerational betrayal. Let's talk about some aspects of this. One of them is the rising cost of tuition. Just how much has college tuition risen, say, compared to inflation?
Well, for the past three decades, starting in the early 1980s, college tuition has consistently gone up much faster than inflation, faster than family income, really faster than any kind of standard measure one could come up with. Every year, 2 or 3 or 4% above the inflation rate, to the point where college is now four times more expensive than it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago.
And you're right, this is driven a lot by college and universities spending. What are they spending money on?
Well, all kinds of things. Colleges and universities are complicated organizations. They've been around for a long time. They are in the teaching business, the scholarship business, the, I would argue, professional sports business in many cases. They spend money on administration. They spend money on new buildings. Most of them are nonprofit, and so they compete with one another not to make money, but for status and prestige. And so they buy things that increase their status and prestige in relation to their competitors.
Like what kinds of things?
Well, sometimes they buy the services of well-known scholars so they can look good among themselves in the scholarly community. They're big on construction. You see a lot of sort of an edifice complex is the term they use sometimes in higher education, where they always want to build new structures that make the university campus look good. They compete for the, quote, best students, particularly at the high end of the higher education market. There's an intense competition for students with high SAT scores. Anything that reflects well on the greater glory of the institution, most of those things can be bought.
Yeah, you know, I always say that when you go to any city, you can find the university by looking for the construction cranes because they're just always building.
Yes.
And you know, I guess one thing they might say is, look, the population of the country is growing. There are more kids, more educated kids looking to go to college, and we got to build these buildings because we need new classrooms, new labs to teach them.
Well, that's partially true. Universities don't do a very good job of using their space. Go to a college campus on a Monday morning or a Friday afternoon, and you'll find a lot of empty buildings and empty classrooms because professors and students don't like to go to class those days. At the same time, it's true the population of the country has increased over time. The percentage of people graduating from high school who go to college has gone up, and that's because the economy has changed. It used to be that you could get a good job by just getting a high school diploma, or not even that, joining a union, going to work for a big company, and you could earn a living for your family. Well, we don't live in that world anymore. Parents and students understand that, and so there's an intense desire to send people on to higher education.
On the other hand, I guess if they're going to admit another, 1,000 or 1,500 students than they did 10 years ago, that's more tuition income. You might expect that they could find the facilities and teachers they need out of those additional tuition payments.
Well, I mean, it's the case that even as the college-going population has increased over time, the number of traditional nonprofit and public colleges and universities has pretty much stayed the same. America went through a great period of expansion of our higher education infrastructure in the middle of the 20th century. We built out a whole system of community colleges. We built big regional public universities. But that all pretty much came to a finish in the mid to late 1970s. You find a few places in Sunbelt states that are still building new universities every now and then. But mostly, we have the universities that we have. Meanwhile, the population got larger, demand for higher education got stronger, and so the existing universities were in an advantaged position where they could charge more for their services, and really people had nowhere else to go.
Now what about, are there more administrators than there used to be? Deans, assistant deans, that kind of thing?
Very much so, and that has been one of the interesting things that has come from studies of how colleges and universities spend their money. It turns out professors aren't really doing all that well. They're not the beneficiaries of the large increase in college spending that has gone on. In fact, the percentage of all students taught by non-tenure-track professors, adjuncts, teaching assistants, has gone up and up and up. So it used to be the majority of all students were taught by someone who was either tenured or tenure-track, and now I think that's less than 40% of students. And so colleges and universities really haven't been passing on all this new revenue and this new spending to their teaching workforce, but they have been expanding the ranks of university administration. More provosts, more deans and vice deans and assistants to the vice dean and so on.
Right. And I know that when this interview airs, we're going to get emails from people who say, you don't know what I do. We do important work in these positions. What are they doing? Do you feel like you know enough to safely say that this is, I don't know, unnecessary?
Well, it may be necessary by some way of thinking. I'm sure that most of those people are working hard at real jobs. They're not sitting around watching television all day. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good idea to continually increase spending and pass many of those costs on to students in the form of higher tuition. Higher education is really the only gateway to opportunity in the economy in which we live now. And the more the prices go up, the more that the students who were squeezed out of opportunity are middle-income students, low-income students, and the net effect over time is really to make our college and university system no longer the engine of economic mobility that it once was.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what drives these decisions. I mean, when universities decide to spend a lot of money on things that aren't related to education, like building big buildings or expanding, a Division I sports program or getting some prestigious chair, who are running these universities and why do they make those choices?
Well, in the end, universities are run for the benefit of the people who work there. And that is different than, say, a for-profit corporation, which is run ultimately for the benefit of shareholders, or a regular government agency that is run for the benefit of elected officials and presumably the public that they serve. Our colleges and universities exist in a kind of an odd position. I think probably the closest analogy is organized religion, where you have nonprofit institutions that have been around for a long, long time, whose nonprofit status is a function of an assumed and in most ways quite real sense that these are organizations that serve the public good, but aren't really accountable to the public. They sustain themselves. They have their own set of values. If you look at the decisions they make, those values are quite apparent. Particularly our four-year colleges and universities, the professional status is bound up in academia, in scholarship. And so these universities are organized in such a way that reflects that. Professors are recruited and paid based on their academic reputations, not on whether they're any good at teaching. And there is a desire for status. There is a constant competition with one another. And the thing about reputational competition is that there's no end to it. You don't ever reach some point where you are as good as you can be, because the only question is, are you as good as the university in the next state or somewhere else in your athletic league? So there's no ceiling to how much money colleges and universities can spend competing with one another, and that's one of the reasons they continue to spend and spend.
Is there a classic case, a poster child for this kind of activity?
There's a certain class of university that has arisen, I would say, in the last 20 years or so. I live in Washington, D.C., and I think one of them is here in Washington, D.C., George Washington University. They tend to be located in urban areas. I would point to New York University in New York, University of Southern California in Los Angeles. These are private research universities that have taken advantage of their fortunate geographic position as part of dynamic urban areas to really rise through the ranks of status in academia, basically on the backs of student tuition. So George Washington, GW, as people call it here, is one of the most expensive colleges and universities in America. They charge, I think, north of $55,000 a year in tuition. And because they're not as wealthy as, say, Georgetown University, which is just right up the street, and they don't attract as wealthy a clientele, a fair amount of that tuition comes from borrowing. Debt levels are unusually high at GW. They're unusually high at NYU.
Student debt levels.
Student debt levels. That's exactly right. So they charge a lot of money, and they use that money to, again, build the buildings and buy the professors and recruit the students and get a better basketball team and all the markers of status in the profession. And it works. Look at the U.S. News rankings, U.S. News and World Report rankings. These are institutions that have risen through the ranks over time. The students who attend have higher SAT scores. Everything seems to be going well. But again, there is a cost to that. And the cost is borne substantially by the students and families who attend.
How influential are the U.S. News and World rankings of colleges and universities? They've been around for a while.
I think they're quite influential. Now, this is a topic of debate sometimes in academia, and people will say, well, students don't really look at those, and there are other things that we care about. And the thing to understand about the U.S. News rankings is that they simply made numbers out of a value system that was already in place. They empiricized a sense of higher education quality that revolves around three things, I would say: wealth, exclusivity, and fame. If you look at all the components of the U.S. News rankings, it's the wealthy institutions that have the smallest admissions rate and are the most well-known for their students and for their professors that always sit atop the list. It's not a coincidence that every year Harvard and Princeton go back and forth between number one and number two. Now, U.S. News didn't invent the idea or the thought that status was a function of wealth and fame and exclusivity. You could say that about lots of things other than higher education. It's perhaps just a fundamental element of human society. What they have done is, I think, lent fuel to the fire, and they've created a mechanism by which universities that haven't been around for hundreds of years are able to climb up through the ranks and kind of claw their way past their competitors from a status basis.
And are public universities engaged in this kind of competition as much as private colleges?
They are, although it's difficult for them because they have more of a public mission. They're obligated to enroll larger numbers of students from the states in which they are located. They're dependent on public funding, which particularly in the last few years has been very difficult for public universities as they've seen their public funding cut. But they definitely inhabit the same value system. If you look at the professors who teach at public universities. A lot of them went to school at the best private universities. Because we churn out a lot more graduate students in this country than we have room for in our tenured faculty. And so what tends to happen is people don't get jobs at universities that are as good as the university where they trained. They tend to, on average, get jobs maybe one or two rungs below. So they bring that value system with them, and on some level, they always want to go back. So I think that our public universities would like to compete with private universities, but it is becoming increasingly difficult for them.
You know, you make the point that as colleges have increased their spending and tuitions have risen, that the experience for particularly, you know, freshman and sophomore undergraduate courses hasn't improved in quality, that you still have big, huge lecture halls. And I guess it raises the question of whether those classes are, in effect, profit centers for pursuing the other goals of these institutions.
The large lecture classes are definitely profit centers. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to do the math if you have, say, 400 students sitting in a large room, each paying $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 in tuition for the class. Multiply 8,000 by 400, and then you have the person standing down in the well of the lecture hall as an adjunct professor who's being paid maybe $5,000 or $10,000 total for the class, or maybe $15,000 if they're on the tenure track. But of course, those are definitely profit centers for colleges and universities. And the entire enterprise of higher education is based on obscure and complicated pricing mechanisms where the price of what you're paying for often has nothing to do with the cost of providing that service. And so for example, in general, there are exceptions in sciences in particular, but in general, you pay the same tuition irrespective of what course you take. And so what that means is that there are massive systems of cross-subsidization inside the finances of a college and university. And one of those systems certainly is one where freshmen and sophomores are essentially subsidizing the cost of teaching juniors and seniors and graduate students and probably paying for some of the building and the football coach and all the rest of it.
We've talked about how college tuition has risen dramatically and the importance of getting a college education in the modern economy has increased, and therefore there is more pressure for students to borrow more, and that's one of the reasons we're seeing such high burdens of student debt. But there's another thing going on, and that's the diminished support from governments for public institutions. Let's talk about that. What are the ways in which, you know, higher education has been subsidized, and how is that changing?
Well, the higher education is subsidized in a variety of ways. In the private nonprofit sector, it's subsidized through tax preferences. You don't pay taxes, and it's subsidized through financial aid. So, if the federal government, and the federal government is the main provider of financial aid, is subsidizing students through grants and loans, then that is essentially a subsidy to the institution. In the public sector, and for community colleges and our public four-year universities, there is a direct public subsidy. These are institutions that are, on some level or another, governed by the public and receive large direct subsidies, a check every year from the state government. The state subsidies have been declining relative to the size of university budgets over time. Now, there's an important distinction here. When you talk to colleges and universities, what they will always say is, well, in 1980, for example, we got, say, half our money from the state government. Now it's only 15%, and that represents a sort of dramatic decline in support. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that is partly a function of the fact that university spending has increased very quickly. So until about 2008 or so, there was a 25-year period where state governments basically kept up with inflation and population growth when it came to spending money on higher education. They didn't keep up with the amount of money that higher education was spending on itself, but they did keep track with inflation and how many students were going to college. An important caveat to that is that support was not consistent. It tended to go down dramatically during economic downtimes. There's a consistent pattern where every time there's a recession, state revenues decline, state spending declines, and spending on colleges and universities is disproportionately cut. And it's because state legislators know that colleges and universities can raise tuition on the back end. So it's kind of a way of raising taxes without raising taxes. The problem, of course, is that when the economy recovers, nobody ever cuts the tuition back. So we have kind of a ratchet effect going on where tuition goes up steeply during recessions and then goes up not quite as steeply during economic good times. Now, from 2008 until now, during the Great Recession, I suppose, as we've come to call it, there has been a serious overall decline in funding per student by any measure from states to their universities, and that has resulted in some dramatic tuition increases in states like, for example, California and Arizona.
Right. I mean, you know, I went to the University of Texas in the 1970s, and I spent more on my living expenses than I did on my tuition and fees. It was a really cheap place to go, and I guess that was a fairly common experience in a lot of public universities then.
Yeah, it was. There was, for quite some time, a matter of decades, there was, I think, a basic bargain in place in this country which said that if you wanted to go to college and you were willing to go to a public university, you could work your way through college, or your parents would be able to pay out of pocket. And in fact, until I went to college in the 1980s, and that was certainly the case for me. My parents paid, I think, $3,000 a year in tuition for me to go to a very good public university. And as late as the early 1990s, the majority of all undergraduates left college with no debt. Today, about two-thirds of all undergraduates leave college owing money, and on average, they owe over $25,000. I would call it an intergenerational betrayal in the sense that the good deal that government provided to one generation was not transmitted onto the next generation. Instead, in a lot of cases, I think tax cuts became more of a priority than funding higher education. But we no longer live in a world where that bargain is available to students, I think. You can find places, but the average student has to borrow now, and that is a big change.
So we have a situation where over the last couple of decades, tuitions have risen dramatically, far more than inflation, and governments have cut back on subsidies for public universities. And a college degree is more important than ever, so students are borrowing. Let's talk about student debt. Just how much of it is there these days?
Well, there was a dramatic figure released last year by the U.S. Treasury indicating that the total amount of outstanding student debt now exceeds $1 trillion, trillion. And in fact, that amount exceeds the total amount of debt owed on credit cards. No one planned for that to happen. No one thought it was a good idea because, in fact, it's a very bad idea. But the reality is that as college tuition has consistently outpaced the ability of people to pay out of pocket, debt has been the safety valve of our higher education system. It is what has allowed everything to keep running because people know they have to go to college. They don't feel they have any choice, and so they just continue to borrow and borrow and borrow.
The typical senior graduates with what's the number, about $25,000 in debt?
So the typical senior who graduates with debt, they don't all do, but about two-thirds. And so of borrowers, the typical senior graduates with over $25,000 in debt.
And they cannot be discharged in bankruptcy, and that was the result of the Bankruptcy Act a few years back, right?
Yes. Yeah. It used to be that you could discharge student loans in bankruptcy, and there was heavy lobbying by the loan industry in the 2000s, and gradually over time those protections were eaten away to the point where now you cannot discharge any student loan in bankruptcy. So basically, this is just an example of an industry hiring, using the money it makes, the money it made, by the way, through public subsidies, to hire a bunch of lobbyists to come to Washington, D.C. and push through a provision that, frankly, is not in the public interest, but is in the interest of the private companies. We live in a country now where you can have your Social Security check garnished in order to pay a student loan that you might have taken out 20 or 30 years before. A lot of debtors end up in a situation where their loans are passed from collection agency to collection agency. Every time it happens, new fees are tacked on. You could borrow $10,000 and end up owing $50,000. Your disability checks can be garnished. It is one of the very few things, other than basically being a murderer, where there's no statute of limitations on something that you did a long, long time ago. And there's a real human cost to that.
So you've written about how college tuitions have risen dramatically and education is more important than ever. So many, many more students are coming out with heavily burdened by loans that will follow them forever. But you've also written about some new educational models that could change the way things work. And let's begin maybe by just talking a little bit about kind of how the traditional educational system has worked. I mean, you've noted that the colleges that were around, 50 or 100 years ago are mostly the ones that are around today, and we aren't seeing new ones there to sort of, in effect, expand the supply of education. Why is that?
Well, partly because building a traditional college or university is very expensive. You just go to one and look around, and there are tons of buildings and people and infrastructure, and those things cost a lot of money to get off the ground. And it really, there is no more stable part of our society than our higher education system. If you were to go back 100 years and say, what are the best universities in America? It would basically be the same list as if you asked that question today. Maybe one or two would have fallen out and one or two would have come in. Whereas if you asked that question about almost anything else, certainly private industry, you would have maybe General Electric is still around. And other than that, it is an entirely different group of people. And so these are institutions whose basic design was fixed in place in the late 19th century when colleges like Harvard and Johns Hopkins decided to adopt the German research university model. This is a model that is built around independent scholars with PhDs, around organizations that have the dual purpose of conducting both research and education at the same time. That is a complicated and expensive way to organize things. It works in a lot of ways, obviously, because these institutions are still around and many of them are extremely prosperous. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the American higher education system is envied around the world for its productivity and its greatness. But it is an increasingly expensive model. And I don't think that institutions that have been around that long really have that much capacity to reorganize themselves. And so if we're going to think about how are we going to provide lower cost alternatives to students, what might bring this unsustainable trend of constantly increasing prices to an end, I think it will have to be new organizations that look very different than the ones we have today.
So let's look at some of the alternative models. Just take one of these innovative programs that you've seen and describe, you know, how it might change things.
Well, of course, at the same time that the college has been getting more and more expensive over the last 15 years, we've had the information technology revolution, where other industries have been absolutely transformed by brand new actors, new companies, new ways of service delivery, often at radically lower prices, often that have major disruptive impacts on existing institutions. And yet higher education seems to have largely escaped that so far. And in fact, you can look at certain predictions and pronouncements that were made in the midst of the dot-com enthusiasm in the late 90s, where people said, oh, you know, brick-and-mortar institutions, universities, that is, they'll be out of business by 2010. Well, it's 2012, and none of them are out of business, or at least very few. But I do think that that is beginning to change. The process of education is one that is substantially a process of the exchange of information. And when you have incredibly new and more efficient and more powerful ways of exchanging information as we do now, in the long run, it is inevitable that the structure of education will change accordingly. And what we have just seen in the last 6 months or so is some real changes in the online higher education space. For most of the 2000s, the online higher education was synonymous with for-profit education. You had companies like the University of Phoenix and Kaplan Universities getting much, much larger and making an awful lot of money by enrolling students online. I think online education was seen as kind of déclassé by traditional colleges and universities who thought that they had that was beneath them somehow. Just this year, however, we've seen very, very large online classes taught at universities like Stanford, MIT. Harvard has announced recently that it's getting into the game of sponsoring online classes that will be sort of associated with Harvard. These are courses that are being taught right now to hundreds of thousands of students around the world, and they don't cost anything. So if you want to talk about a radical competitor to the expensive college degree, try Xero.
Right. Now, let's talk about this. There was the case of the Stanford course, which was in, I forget what subject.
Artificial intelligence.
Okay. And it was available to anybody for free. Mm-hmm. And how many people followed the course or participated?
Well over 100,000.
Okay.
I think getting up to 200,000, perhaps. Right.
Now, no doubt they learn a lot, but they don't end up with a college credit, do they? Mm-hmm. How does this get translated into something that society recognizes as, you know, a real education, a real credential?
Well, that is the question that everybody is thinking about now. There is, I think, now no doubt that certain kinds of students, not everybody, but certain kinds of students can learn a lot, as you say, online. But people don't just go to college to learn. They go to college to get a credential that can help them get a job. That's the difference between a library and a college. Or one of the differences. And I think recognizing this, the professors that taught this class at Stanford, and it should be said that the Stanford professors kind of just did this on their own. They didn't even ask for permission ahead of time. They just opened their class up to the internet. And as it turns out, while Stanford, the university, was very enthusiastic about this kind of innovative, broadly reaching class being taught by one of their professors, they were also very, very concerned that there be no confusion about the fact that students who were not paying Stanford to take this class, those students were not going to receive Stanford credits. Stanford credits are very expensive. Only a small number of students are allowed to get them. So what happened was the professors who taught the class for the students who satisfactorily passed the class based on tests that they took online, got a letter from the professor saying, "Dear such and such, this letter officially certifies that you took this class," and or something along those lines, and in some cases perhaps graduated or scored in the top 10% of the class. Sincerely, such and such person who is a professor at Stanford. So we're really getting into the realm of semantic distinctions now. Because in the end, all a college degree is a piece of paper saying that, "Dear such and such, you took these classes and here's how you did in them." Nothing more, nothing less. It is a piece of paper that has the seal of approval from an institution that has been itself approved through a process of government endorsement and accreditation, but the essential act of communication is the same.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kevin Carey. He is the director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation and has written widely on education policy. Well, are there cases where institutions are offering online learning and people are getting college credit for, you know, little or no cost?
There are companies out there, yes, that are very much trying to offer extremely low-cost, not free, but extremely low-cost college classes that do lead to college credits. So, for example, there is a company called Straighter Line, not an accredited university. All they do is offer online classes in introductory courses. So these are the courses that colleges and universities currently make a lot of money on by charging high tuition for what are often large impersonal lecture classes. Algebra, economics, accounting, biology. They offer these classes for a flat subscription rate of, I believe, $99 a month, plus another $20 or $30 for textbooks. And they have an arrangement with accredited colleges where once you take these classes, you can transfer them in to an accredited college for credit, and then use those credits to pursue a degree. So they've kind of hacked the system. It's a workaround. Because Straighter Line isn't accredited, they can't offer credits, but accredited colleges can accept Straighter Line classes, and students can proceed from there.
It's sort of curious that an accredited institution would enter into a relationship with a company like Straighter Line, because if, as you said, they do very well charging people tuition for these big introductory, you know, lecture classes. Why would they have an arrangement with Straighter Line?
Well, you can't use your Straighter Line credits to transfer into Harvard or University of Virginia or, you know, University of Michigan or the elite institutions. What you can do is use your Straighter Line credits to transfer into more mid-tier, but still, in many ways, probably very good institutions that provide a kind of a solid, affordable education. Institutions that are not turning students away. And we should keep in mind that most colleges and universities are not all that selective. So institutions that are not turning customers away right and left actually have an interest in trying to enroll more students. So I think they see the connection to straighter line students as a way of connecting to a new market, students who might not otherwise have known about them, and they can bring them in and enroll them in more advanced classes, and that's still a good financial proposition for them, and they become graduates.
Now, how are the accredited universities reacting to this?
I think that accredited universities look at new competition from online providers with a fair amount of apprehension. They are, by and large, run by smart people, and they understand that information technology has a powerful disruptive potential to change business models and provide new ways of services that can shake up the economics of a long-established industry. On some level, the fact that they are accredited is what is keeping them in business. It's important to understand not anybody can just be a college or university. You have to go through a system of approval, which happens to be run by nonprofit organizations that are comprised of existing colleges and universities. The federal government doesn't itself decide who can accept federal financial aid money. And federal financial aid money is playing an increasingly important role in financing American higher education. It outsources that job to nonprofit accrediting organizations, which are membership organizations of existing colleges and universities. So there's a bit of a fox guarding the henhouse situation going on, where if you come with a new, much less expensive business model, and you want to compete on a level playing field with universities that are getting implicitly large government subsidies because they can accept Pell Grants and they can accept student loans, you have to get the approval of your competitors to do that. And so far, the competitors haven't been all that eager to grant that approval. What they more or less do is make you demonstrate that you have the cost structure of a traditional university. So they'll ask you questions about, well, how big is your library? And what credentials do your professors have? And so on. Even if your model doesn't involve having a library or employing professors at all.
You know, I can imagine folks hearing about online learning and thinking, well, that's great. I've seen ads for these institutions that will, you know, give me degrees. I mean, there are plenty of for-profit institutions out there offering, you know, online courses. Do you have any advice for people, any things they should consider in whether they want to enroll in one of these places?
Well, I would look at, certainly look at the price. If the institution is encouraging you to borrow a lot of money, I would think pretty hard about whether that's the right place to go. If you go on the federal government has a website called College Navigator. If you just do a search for College Navigator, you can look up these institutions and you can see what percentage of students who enroll graduate and get degrees. You can see how often students borrow, how much they borrow, and whether they tend to default on their loans. Interestingly enough, this week, the federal government is scheduled to release a bunch of new information about mostly for-profit colleges that are the result of a new regulation that was put in last year, where the U.S. Department of Education is going to rate for-profit colleges by looking at how much money graduates make after they finish, and comparing that to how much money graduates of for-profit colleges borrow. And if the ratio is too far in one direction, if students are borrowing a lot of money and they're earning very little in the job market afterwards, those for-profit colleges will be kicked out of the federal financial aid system. So that data also will be available, and that is also something that consumers should take a look at.
You've said that the internet, it took a while, but it radically changed the media industry, and newspapers, you know, suffered a serious decline. Mm-hmm. What's higher education going to look like in 15 years? Will we have more students being able to get an affordable college education without being burdened by so much debt?
I think so, yes. The long-term price trend and debt trend cannot continue going this way forever. A wise man once said the thing about unsustainable trends is that they end by definition. So too with the long-term trend of college always getting much more expensive and students borrowing more and more money. There has to be a breaking point. And I think that pressure from high quality, and again, I emphasize that, high quality online lower cost alternatives or hybrid models that combined in-person and online classes at a much lower cost, as people become more comfortable with this kind of education, as credentials from these kinds of universities become more widely accepted, that will be the thing that really starts to put pressure on traditional institutions and drives them to adapt on some level or go out of business. And there will be some of both.
Well, Kevin Carey, we're out of time. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Kevin Carey is director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation and writes on education issues for the New Republic, Washington Monthly, and the Chronicle of Higher Education.